Do you still not understand what Seti was?
He was a great leader.
His hands bore the blood of thousands of children.
Slaves.
My people. And I can no longer hide in the desert while they suffer. At your hands.
Let's get together. I'll say it first. We all love power. And it's time for Kill McCast. Yeah, it's time for Kill McCast.
Welcome to Kill McCast. Here is your host, Francis Rizzo III.
Thanks, Bernard. Welcome to all the Valve Pals listening out there to a new episode of KilmerCast. I'm your host, Francis Rizzo III, and I'm here to talk about the films of Val Kilmer, one of the most truly fascinating American film actors of the modern era. On this episode, we'll be checking out Kilmer's role as both Moses and God in the 1998 animated DreamWorks film, The Prince of Egypt. Joining us to chat about the film and Kilmer's role in it is Forbes film critic and box office expert, and the only person I know who actually understands how a multiplier works, it's Scott Mendelson. How are you doing today, Scott?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me. You know, as someone who makes their living, obviously, in the film industry like you, you had to dive right back into the theaters. But to me, it feels like it's going a little slow getting people back into theaters. What do you think?
Yes, to the first part, of course. I went as soon as I could. And to be honest, I probably went earlier than I should have. But oh, well, I always wore a mask. I drove down to Vegas to see Tenet on opening night.
Oh, wow.
Because I lived in California, and you know, theaters were still closed that back in Labor Day. But anyway, two things of note. First of all, this is the first act of a slow and rocky theatrical recovery, the full form of which we won't know for a while. Second, we should remember that most of the big safe tentpoles that were going to open this year for the summer, Jurassic World 3, Venom 2, Spider-Man 3, The Batman, et cetera, et cetera, they got out of Dodge.
Yeah.
Most of the films actually scheduled for this summer are horror franchises, Quiet Place, Spiral, Candyman, Conjuring, Don't Breathe, Old, Escape Room. Mm-hmm. And those films are cheap enough to not require best case scenario box office to be financially viable. For example, The Forever Purge, it's earned about $75 million, and that's about half of what the first Purge earned, but that's still triple its $25 million budget. The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, has made $195 million worldwide, and that's well below most, you know, Conjuring slash Annabelle slash Nun movies, but it's still five times the film's $39 million budget. Now, other than horror films, you have two big films that are, I would argue, taking one for the team. And by that, F9 and Black Widow. Black Widow had to get out sooner rather than later because it connects to the Disney Plus TV shows.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I'm cynical and mercenary about it, that's why it came out now, regardless of what form, Disney Plus or otherwise. F9, I think Universal wanted F9 to be sort of what Tenet tried to be last year. And to a certain extent it was, with the caveat this time North America was actually helping. You got to remember about Tenet is it was considered a whiff, and you know, there were, it was followed by a deluge of post-2020 or late 2020 date changes.
Yes.
But that was more because theaters in New York and Los Angeles never opened. I think if theaters in New York had opened, we probably would have, for better or worse, we'd have already seen No Time to Die by now. And it's made $363 million worldwide, which this summer is a downright aspirational total. It also made $305 overseas. It only, frankly, disappointed slash outright flopped in North America, where it only made $58 million. This time around, F9 has done $169 million. It'll have $171 by the end of the weekend. That's lower than, you know, most recent Fast and Furious sequels, but not by an egregious amount.
No.
Especially when you consider, A, we're in a pandemic. B, there's a shortened theatrical window. C, it's Fate of the Furious was not one of the best Fast and Furious films. And I would argue F9 is also not one of the best Fast and Furious films.
Yep.
And E, for what it's worth, this is the first Fast and Furious film since 2006 that features neither Dwayne Johnson nor Paul Walker. So more than any other installment, it's the Dom Toretto show. that is something to consider, considering that, you know, as far as we know, Dwayne Johnson will not be reprising in the last two Fast and Furious films, because I guess he and Vin Diesel don't get along.
Yeah, and he's got his own franchise now with Hobbs and Shaw.
Exactly. I mean, he's a pretty busy guy. He's sort of the Bella Thorne of global action stars. Excuse me, the Bella Thorne of global action stars. In the time we're recording this podcast, she's done two indie movies and written three magazine articles.
Yeah, I've gone to several films since theaters opened up here in New York. And the largest crowd I've actually been with is five people, which, I mean, admittedly, I go on early mornings on the weekends. That's my thing. I like to go before anybody else does. But it still feels like that's very small compared to what it was in the past. And I'm wondering if it's a combination of just the films that are available, or did the getting comfortable with streaming at home just ruin things?
I think it ruined things. I don't think it helped things. You know, for the record, you know, and I also think, what we're going to see is a further emphasis on what I always consider to be sort of the darkest timeline scenario. This was before COVID, which is that people who used to go to the movies just to go to the movies have stopped. As of about 5, maybe 6 years ago, they go to the event films. Now, an event film can be a, you know, a Marvel superhero movie. It could be a Conjuring flick. It could be John Wick. But it has to be, or a Mamma Mia. But it has to be something considering an event film. Do I want to see this film? Do I want to see it in theaters? Do I want to see it now? Because if neither of those things apply, you can, and this is before COVID, you could wait 90 days and rent it for $5 on your HDTV. And what I think this has emphasized is that when theaters do quote unquote come back, you're going to see global box office may be steady. Ticket sales will go up and down, or, you know, down, but not dramatically so. Because honestly, they haven't, contrary to popular belief. Ticket sales have been almost steady since the early 90s. But what's changed is that a far larger percentage of the overall box office is spent on a far smaller portion of films. I'm going off memory here, so I apologize. But I think in 2018, the top six movies accounted for, I think, 25% of the total box office. You know, that was Black Panther, Avengers, Incredibles, Jurassic World, and gosh darn it, I don't remember the fifth.
It's okay.
Anyway, Aquaman.
There you go.
And then, you know, Deadpool was in, two was in sixth place. So you have, you know, films are sort of being, theatrical films are sort of being treated now as a comfort food, which isn't a bad thing, but you know, what is comforting right now is familiarity, nostalgia, something that I enjoyed once before and I'm hopefully going to enjoy again. And now that the marquee character has surpassed both IP in the generic sense and actors and actresses as the driving force for what gets people in the theater, you don't have as much of a market for outright original or quote unquote new to you adaptations as you did back in the time when a movie star could get butts in the seats. It wasn't, you know, people didn't show up to Hitch because they had an unquenchable thirst for original content. They showed up to Hitch because it looked like a really clever Will Smith romantic comedy with a good hook, halfway decent reviews, and that was enough. Wild Hogs is not a great movie. You know, it's about, but it had a good hook. It had three well-known male actors. You know, I think it was John Travolta, William H. Macy, and, oh, come on, I'm killing myself here. Okay, what are the other ones? I'm sounding like Rick Perry all day. But nonetheless, it was about, you know, over the hill midlife crisis men who basically formed their own motorcycle group. You know, it was, and the movie opened with $46 million in, I think, 2006, 2007. Ended up with like 164 domestic, 250 worldwide on like a $50 million budget. Incredibly profitable. This used to be what a hit movie looked like. And everything, you know, the big, big, big stuff, those were tent poles. In the old days, tent poles meant literally a movie that's so big and so guaranteed of a hit that it keeps the rest of the studio afloat and can, you know, mitigate the losses for, you know, a film that doesn't do well.
I have to say that the phrase, the Wild Hogs, is not a very good movie. It might be the biggest understatement ever stated on this show.
Oh, I'm going for drawl understatement. Absolutely. Oh, yes. It was befuddled because I can't think of the third actor. You know what? When you start talking for a while, I'm just sneakily looking up at my phone because things are nuts.
Yeah, it's funny that we talk about big tentpole films, and there actually is going to be a Val Kilmer one coming up soon, which is Top Gun Maverick. And so I don't know how much Val Kilmer will be in that film, but it is an opportunity to talk about your favorite Val Kilmer film, because we'll use that as our segue. What of the Kilmer canon is your favorite film?
I think my least favorite film was Prince of Egypt. It's just a real piece of garbage, and I hate talking about it. What are we talking about today?
I think today's the same.
if we're talking about favorites, not necessarily the best. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, so I love Batman Forever.
Okay.
It wasn't as dark and gritty and macabre as the Burton films, and those are better pictures. Mm-hmm. But I think he is probably, Val Kilmer, I would say to a certain extent, is the best Batman.
Okay.
On screen, live action. And by that I mean, he's not the best Batman, he's not the best Bruce Wayne, but he's really good at both.
Yeah.
I would argue, for example, Christian Bale is an awesome Bruce Wayne. I think as much as I love those films, and I do, he's kind of still ridiculous as Batman. Ben Affleck is a very imposing Batman. I think he's, especially in BVS, he's an underwritten Bruce Wayne.
Mm. Yeah, they don't really care about Bruce Wayne in that film at all.
Well, it's a very plot-centric picture. And then, Michael Keaton, childhood favorite, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
He's Bruce Wayne. Kind of intentionally so, but he's not a very charismatic fella.
No.
Certainly, more so than in any other Batman movie. I would say the Burton films are Elseworlds.
I could see that, definitely.
I adore them. They're childhood favorites. But I think Batman Forever is probably the definitive Batman film in the sense of, I just feel like watching a Batman movie. And it's a big, bright, colorful action-adventure picture with Batman, Robin, Riddler, Two-Face. And again, it's not the best. It's especially if you're with your kids, it's a very comfort watch.
Mm, I'll definitely scratch the itch.
In terms of more quality Val Kilmer pictures, The Doors, obviously, that's a monumental performance. I like Mindhunters. I know it's not good, but I enjoy it. Rennie Harlan's Mindhunters.
That is a rare pick here.
I think the first two acts of The Dial of Dr. Moreau are excellent.
Mm.
Regardless of what that movie was supposed to be, because I've heard all this, I'm sure you've,
absolutely.
You've definitely heard the horror stories. But I think the first two acts in that film are very strong. I think it kind of falls apart right around when Kilmer dies, actually.
Mm.
I think David Thewlis is very good. It's just, it becomes a more generic spectacle at that point.
Yeah, I would definitely agree.
Kiss Bang Bang is excellent.
Yes.
I mean, it speaks for itself. Of course, it's great. Salt and Sea is good. Ghost in the Darkness, I enjoy. Wasn't a fan of The Saint, which is why I'm sort of chuckling to myself that they're trying to reboot that one. Like, that wasn't a hit in 1997, back when people went to the movies.
No. I mean, it didn't work when they tried to bring it back as a TV movie also. After two tries,
yeah,
just stop.
I see that.
Try something new.
And I know I'm forgetting a bunch of more prestigious films, because that was on the top of my tongue right now.
Yeah, I think that's funny about Val Kilmer is that for most people, it's not his more recognizably good films that people enjoy. It's his more fun films that people enjoy.
Yes. I mean, to be fair, he made a lot of very commercial pictures.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't as much of a, you could only do this, or there really is no market for this that there is arguably today. I mean, Tom Cruise, among many other things, sort of pioneered the idea that a movie star could work with the best directors humanly possible and let those directors push him to as far as he could go in a given character. Mm. And we saw that emulated in Matt Damon, Leonardo DiCaprio, and that generation that wanted to be actors first and movie stars second.
Mm.
Val Kilmer is sort of a happy medium.
Yeah.
This is not like Batman was his first commercial picture. Thunderheart's a very good film. It's aged very well.
Thunderheart is fantastic.
I'm rambling. I'll let you take over for a moment.
Well, before we dive into today's film, we should probably go back in time and see what was going on around the time of that film.
Gather round as we put Kilmer in context.
So The Prince of Egypt was released in America on December 18th, 1998. in terms of diversity of news, it really was a pretty quiet time because everyone was focused on one particular moment, which would be the House of Representatives voting to impeach Bill Clinton on two of the four charges that he faced, perjury and obstruction of justice. You remember that time?
Oh, is there an audio excerpt? Okay, sorry. No, I'm not going to play a news excerpt.
I'm not going to play a clip of that.
Yes, I mean, I was, you know, I was 18 and I was definitely following politics. Mm-hmm. And even then I knew it was nonsense. Many times in my life as a kid, as a young adult, and now as a 40-year-old, I'm like, how comes I get this, but these smart, powerful people don't?
Maybe they're not that smart.
Well, that's what I've come to realize, unfortunately.
Yeah. I find it very interesting that they actually declined to impeach Clinton on charges, the second charge of perjury and a charge of abuse of power. And as I was looking back at this, I was like, oh, like, you know, who was involved in this at all? And I found out that one of the key nay votes that got him off of the second perjury charge was Lindsey Graham, which it would change a lot in the next impeachment proceedings.
Well, I mean, obviously he was never going to get thrown out of office because the Senate was Democrat, you know, didn't have 66 Republicans.
Yes.
So it was entirely a dog and pony show. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it worked. I genuinely believe if Clinton hadn't gotten himself into trouble, and obviously he shares quite a bit of the blame.
Certainly.
Al Gore would have run a more conventional campaign. He would have used Bill Clinton as a surrogate, and it probably would have been a much easier path to victory for him.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I mean, obviously, Bill Clinton shouldn't have done the thing that he did, but I don't think there's anyone that was paying attention at that time that did not see that this was a politically motivated, I know the phrase witch hunt is a cliche, but that's really what it felt like at the time.
Yeah,
he was the first baby boomer president. His victory was a shock after two terms of Reagan and one of Bush. Republicans thought they were going to hold the Oval Office forever. And they basically, if I recall, they voted to impeach in a lame duck session.
Yes.
So they had lost a bunch of seats because the American people said, you've got bigger things to worry about. Mm-hmm. Thank you much. But they sort of did it anyway, just as a parting FU. And yeah, I mean, would Al Gore have won the election? Probably. Would the Clinton administration have kept, you know, more eyes on the Osama bin Laden ball? Maybe.
Maybe.
The irony is he did, for better or worse, launch a missile strike targeting Osama bin Laden in the middle of the quote-unquote scandal, and he got accused of wagging the dog almost instantly.
Yeah.
That was the narrative, that he was, you know, trying to blow up Osama bin Laden just to take the press attention away from the quote-unquote Lewinsky scandal. Whether or not that was true, it's, you know, as they say on Twitter, tweets that did not age well. But yeah, other stuff that was going on in late 98, the film Prince of Egypt opened the weekend before Christmas in 1998, which is frankly one of the best weekends to open any movie, because you get 2 weeks of holiday legs where everyone's off school, a lot of people are off work, and you have weekdays that act like weekends. Mm-hmm. So you have, that's one reason why, you know, incredible huge legs for The Greatest Showman, Titanic, Avatar, The Lord of the Rings films, The Force Awakens, not so much The Last Jedi, because that film didn't have its Christmas break starting until its second Monday, which is one reason why the film was more front-loaded than expected, which unfortunately played into the whole everybody hates The Last Jedi narrative, which apparently Disney bought hook, line, and sinker.
Which is ridiculous.
I shall avoid the discourse. But yes, You've Got Mail was the top grossing film that weekend.
Yep.
It would earn approximately $17 million on opening weekend. Prince of Egypt opened around $14 million. They would both make it past $100 million domestic, which at the time made Prince of Egypt, I believe, the biggest. I think it was the first non-Disney film to cross $100 million domestic. It was the second DreamWorks picture following it.
Yeah, actually, it opened in 400 more theaters than You've Got Mail, but was beaten by You Got Mail, which I think at that time, I think most people would have expected that a, you know, musical animated film around Christmas time would have dominated. But Tom Hanks cannot be beat.
Well, no, because even You Got Mail, I think it's a PG-rated movie.
Yeah.
Which even then was a little surprising for a live action film. So, And again, the nice thing about Christmas is you know, there's plenty of room for everybody. Hmm. I mean, a week later, Patch Adams opens with 25 million and legs out to 135.
Yeah.
Not a good movie, but people showed up. And the thing about, and I'm going to avoid talking about the movie because I know that's later. In terms of where DreamWorks was at this time, this was their second film. Ants had opened in October and it made about $70 million. Bugs Life would double that in Thanksgiving. More than double that, actually.
Yeah.
Wait, did Ants 70 or 90? I want to say 90.
I believe it was 90.
This was back in the very, very early stages of DreamWorks, where the idea behind Katzenberg's animation studio wasn't just to challenge Disney in a generic sense. It was supposed to be the edgier, more challenging, more grown up big screen feature film animation. If you've seen Ants, you know it's PG back before that was par for the course, and it earns the PG. I mean, there's action and violence and gore in that film that makes it feel like a buggy Starship Troopers for kids trapped inside a pretty stereotypical Woody Allen picture. Back when you were allowed to still admit you liked Woody Allen pictures.
Yes.
Prince of Egypt, of course, was PG, and it was a drama. Mm. It had, musical numbers, and there were certainly moments of comedy, but it was absolutely a drama with actual on-screen murder and blood and plagues killing innocent civilians by the scores. And so it was and an all-star cast. So it was very much positioned as DreamWorks will do what Disney can't.
Mm.
So in a stupidly simplistic way, it was the Joker of the late 90s. And, I say that jokingly, but to a certain extent, I would argue that at this point in time, DC is DreamWorks, good DreamWorks, like mid-2000s, while Marvel is, of course, Disney, for better or worse.
And that's a really good comparison because, when you think about it, Marvel and Disney, well, obviously, since they are combined now to one company, it makes even more sense as a comparison. Marvel and Disney both, had everything to lose if you messed up because they were the champions, and DreamWorks and DC have nothing to lose because they're the underdogs. So why not go for it and make films like The Suicide Squad and, like you said, Ants and all some people view as knockoff films of the versions that everybody liked, like The Bug's Life. You could do something a little different and find a different audience and maybe cross a couple of different demographics and build a success where you might otherwise just be a direct-to-video also run.
Absolutely. And the cruel irony of DreamWorks is that their reputation, fair or not, eventually became known as kiddie movies. Mm. The more juvenile, glorified babysitter animated features compared to the more prestigious Pixar and Disney stuff.
Mm.
And I wouldn't even say it's Shrek that caused that. Shrek, by the way, which is an Oscar-winning blockbuster that was pitched to adults.
Mm.
But the lessons of the success, the pop culture references, the song, the song, the karaoke numbers, yep. The all-star cast, the self-satirical humor, yada, yada, yada. The movie works despite those things. It's a good film.
Yeah.
The sequel is an excellent romantic drama. All four of the Shrek films, even though the later sequels that aren't that good, are surprisingly realistic portraits of adult relationships and marriage and children.
Mm.
I was always very shocked that in Shrek 3, Shrek is very nervous about all the things that he's scared are going to happen and are going to change because of being a father. Mm. And then in Shrek Forever After, they've all come true.
Yeah.
I was in the early stages of my first kid when Shrek 3 and then Shrek 4 came out, and I could relate.
You see the mirror.
Being a parent is literally the best of times and worst of times.
While we're talking about box office, we should talk about a movie that I don't think most people remember would have been in the top 10 at the time, which was Jack Frost, which starred Michael Keaton as a bad dad who was brought back to life as a snowman. The idea that this movie was actually number 5 for, and it was in its second week, so it was still succeeding in its second week, although it never got anywhere near its budget. It only took in $10 million in its second week and cost $85 million to make because of all the CGI in that film.
which is why I always say that generally speaking, rank is almost irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's all about the number, because it's you can be number one for weeks if the competition isn't there, but if you're not making the money you need, it doesn't matter.
Absolutely.
But yes, Jack Frost, another wholesome family favorite of Christmas 98.
And also that week, we had The Thin Red Line, which was only grabbed...
Another wholesome family favorite of Christmas.
Exactly.
Bring the kids. I'll get a nap.
That one only grabbed 86,000.
I like the film.
Yeah. Oh, it's a solid film. But it was in limited release. Yeah. And I don't think you see limited release films make the top 10 anymore. I don't think that happens. Do you?
No. No. Very rarely. Just because, I mean, frankly, since for obvious reasons, since COVID, the platform release is basically extinct. Mm. I mean, you know, I'm sure in normal times, A24 would have released The Green Knight at the Arclight and maybe the Landmark and a couple New York theaters for a week and then gone semi-wide. And then in week three would have reached a theater near you.
Mm. Can't do that anymore.
But now with Green Knight and Zola, they just bam, went wide and they're on PVOD in, you know, under a month.
Mm.
Or that it makes sense because, you know, those films have a fan base and have a want to see factor where there are people that would have seen it in theaters if it was possible and or safe to do so. And as such, they will absolutely plunk down that $20 to watch it on PVOD.
Mm.
And that's where the whole, you know, shifting theatrical windows thing gets complicated. And not to get way off the subject, but, you know, the whole, this movie's available after 18 days for $20, you're chasing a really weird demographic, especially when things go back to normal.
Mm.
You have people that aren't going to run out and see the movie in theaters right away, but also aren't willing to wait till it's, you know, you can rent it for $5 in 90 days.
Mm.
And I don't know how big this strange demographic slice happens to be. And it made sense during the pandemic when theaters were closed and, you know, or theaters were, you know, scarcely open and nobody was going, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But when things return to some semblance of normality, again, I don't know what that demographic is going to look like, that we don't want to see it in theaters right away, but we're too impatient to wait for conventional, you know, post-theatrical.
Yeah. That's going to be a tough one to plan for. Let's take a look at the top of the Billboard charts at the time. So, you know, I've definitely seen songs during this segment on the show pop up where I don't remember the songs. This is a rare time when all top three songs are basically a mystery to me. So at number one was a pairing that I didn't even know existed, which was R. Kelly and Celine Dion. So they gave us a song called I'm Your Angel. It's a very pedestrian duet, and I have zero memory of it. Do you recognize this song at all?
No, it's completely escaped my memory.
Yeah, it's...
I was on a family cruise for like... Actually, I was going on a cruise. I was leaving. So that Friday, I skipped school. So I put TV in the morning so I could see it before I left for the vacation.
So you left pop culture behind.
Even then, I was, you know... Yes.
So,
and I'll tell you, that cruise, they had no newspapers. And this is before everybody had internet. So I was kind of adrift not knowing what was going on. Especially wondering, you know, is Bill Clinton going to capitulate and resign to these idiots?
Yeah, wow, that's a hard time to live right there without any connection to news.
Indeed.
Well, this, I think part of the reason why we don't recognize the song and the fact that it hasn't had any kind of real legacy is that Celine Dion had the song removed from all streaming platforms once the R. Kelly allegations came out. So, you know, I think this kind of, she hoped this song people would be forgotten.
Yeah, I get that. It's a shame because, you know, I Believe I Can Fly is a great song.
Yeah. Nobody wants to talk about it, though. Well, number two, we had Nobody's Supposed to Be Here by Deborah Cox, which, again, I don't know this singer or this song. Starts off very slow.
I was not paying attention in 98.
No, apparently me neither. She's apparently a very big deal in the dance charts, which is not my cup of tea. I'm not a big dance guy. Obviously you are, as you're moving it right now.
I like to, you put another DreamWorks film, I like to move it and or move it.
Yeah, I don't think that she has as big an impact on the German music scene as apparently she has on the dance charts. And this song does nothing for me. I don't know about you. Very slow. Just not a great song for me. I can't imagine that being the number two song on the charts at the time.
It seems more like a slow dance song for middle school.
Right? Keep some space between you. And then at number three was Lately by Divine. Again, a song I don't know and a band I don't know. Do you know this group or this song?
I do know Divine vaguely, but I couldn't name any songs.
Yeah, apparently they were a short-lived girl group. And they only lasted a couple of years. They gave up in 2000. They were done. And their lasting legacy is that one of the members eventually competed on American Idol, and that's about it. But this song was number 3 on the charts.
I have to remember that, you know, in high school, I was super cool listening to movie scores instead of music.
Hey, we all have our thing, right? And look where it got you. Jumping over to TV, we were in the height of yet another period of NBC dominance as they boasted the top 5 shows in the ratings, led by ER and then the Thursday night lineup of Frasier, Friends, Veronica's Closet, and then in 5th place, Jesse. Do you remember Jesse?
Christina Applegate?
Yes, Christina Applegate.
Because, I mean, all due respect, there's like an interchangeable lineup that entire decade of
certainly
shows on Thursday that weren't Frasier, Seinfeld, or Friends.
Yeah.
I like Caroline in the City. I will defend it unto death. The Single Guy, not so much. Suddenly Susan, whatever. Mm. The Kirstie Alley one, that's...
Veronica's Closet.
I don't remember what you just said. Veronica's Closet, I did not enjoy that one at all. Mm-hmm. And Jesse, I don't think I remember watching.
No.
But yeah, that's a whole subgenre in and of itself.
This show has become something of an archive of that, because it seems like each episode when we do a show, a film from the 90s, boom, there's another different NBC show in there that we've never watched, never heard of. So in this one, Christina Applegate is a single mom working in her dad's bar in Buffalo, New York. It only aired for 2 years, and it started out super strong, 5th in the ratings, and then dropped down to 20th. It kept losing its lead in from Friends, and NBC said, yeah, we can't keep doing this, even though they kept doing it. They just kept putting a show in there that nobody would watch after Friends and could never find something to keep those numbers going.
They tried. I don't think what else aired there. I think News Radio get a Thursday slot for a little bit?
It's very possible. I mean, there was one show that we did on actually 2 episodes ago called The Awful Truth. The Naked Truth. There was a different show called The Awful Truth with Taya Leone, which was basically like a carbon copy of Jesse, where 2 seasons, once behind Friends, huge, then not behind Friends, and nothing. And you know, it's amazing how they just kept trying these. And it was very much, a lot of them were very much a single woman, her friends, and her romantic relationships. And they never really tried a whole lot else.
Well, Single Guy, but I don't think that lasted that long either.
No, and that was kind of like just a reversal of it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's sad because I guarantee you look at the ratings that got those shows canceled, and they would be just Walking Dead worthy by today's standards.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, today, Jesse would be the number 1 show on television if you had the same ratings.
When they finally gave up on Homicide after 7 years, partially because Brandon Tarkoff wasn't there anymore and he was a champion of the show, I think it had like 10 million viewers a week. And by today's standards, Jesus.
That's amazing.
The irony is the show they replaced it with got even worse ratings and didn't last an entire season.
Seems like the way it works.
Whatever. I mean, you know, again, you know, it had Homicide at 70 years. I'm not going to, it annoys me sometimes when I see, like, you know, the Save Hannibal contingents, like, guys, they aired it for 3 years. Nobody watched.
Yeah.
They did the work.
At some point you pull the plug. Yeah. Try something different.
Yeah, like with Arrested Development. Mm-hmm. It's like, they finally pulled the plug on Arrested Development when new episodes of Arrested Development were getting worse ratings than repeats of Prison Break.
Yeah.
I like Arrested Development the same as every other TV nerd, but when that happens, it's time to go.
Yeah, not everybody's watching. Sorry. Well, we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back to talk about The Prince of Egypt. Welcome back to KilmerCast. Let's get into this film. So The Prince of Egypt was written by Philip Lezebnik, with additional material from Nicholas Meyer. Now, Lezebnik has one of the more unique careers in screenwriting I've come across. He started off on the network sitcom Day by Day, which is a mostly forgotten offshoot of Family Ties. I don't know if you remember that show. I don't. I did not remember it until I looked it up. Very little. It had Courtney Thorne Smith and Thora Birch, actually, in one of her early roles. I kind of want to watch it now that I've seen like who's on it, but it's gone to the ether of television. And then he went on to write on Wings, the Disney Channel sitcom The Torkelsons, and some episodes of Star Trek, but then turned it around and then started writing animated films. He did Pocahontas, Mulan, and Road to El Dorado. That's a pretty good run there. And then obviously including The Prince of Egypt as well.
Yeah, this is good.
I mean, that's an interesting trajectory to go from those sitcoms to these really big animated films.
I would have to guess just offhand that there was something about him that gave him an ability to do, you know, animated dramas.
Yeah.
Because with the arguable exception of Road to El Dorado, those are not generally comedies.
No, not at all. Especially
they have comedic moments, obviously.
The interesting thing is that when he finished those, he then moved to Denmark and started writing Danish television and movies and has not looked back at Hollywood at all since then. And part of it is that his wife is Danish. And when his children moved out of the home, they said, hey, we'll go back to your homeland of Denmark and make a new start. I don't think that's a thing most people in his position would have done after all that big Hollywood success to just uproot to Denmark and work there.
It's a nice idea, especially these days.
This is true, yes. I can't imagine how easy it was to just say, you know what, forget Disney, forget DreamWorks, I'm going to Denmark. States of the D deal, at least, but, you know.
That is fascinating.
It is. It's a very strange path, and I'd love to talk to him about it because I can't imagine what the thought process is behind that. But, hey, love is love, right? And sometimes it makes you blind and you do whatever.
Directed by Brenda Chapman, right?
Yes. Well, actually, what's interesting is that this film, although it's very common in animated films to have co-directors, this one had three, which I don't think is very common to have three directors. You had Brenda Chapman, who animation veteran. She worked on Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling, Heathcliff, The Real Ghostbusters. She wrote on The Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. But this was her first directing job, which is a pretty strong start on The Prince of Egypt. She then went and did Brave for Pixar, and she did a recent movie, a live action film called Come Away, which was an Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan mashup.
Yes.
I haven't seen it. Did you see it?
I have not. That reminds me, I need to see it.
Yeah, it sounded really interesting.
She directed it. I might have seen it sooner if I knew that. She quite obviously got a very raw deal with Pixar, but
true.
At least she got an Oscar out of it.
This is true. Joining her in the directing chair was Steve Hickner, who is another longtime animator. He worked on He-Man and Pac-Man, lots of men. And he also was making his directing debut on this film as well. And then would go on to actually direct B-Movie. So this movie was a real jumping off point for those two. And then on the third one was Simon Wells, who he, unlike the other, were an old hand at directing. He did plenty of films. He did Five Will Goes West. He did Balto. He did We're Back, A Dinosaur Story, which is always an amusing one to me because the fact that We're Back, A Dinosaur Story is written by John Patrick Shanley is just, it blows my mind every time I think about it. I'm like, Moonstruck and We're Back.
Yeah, I remember the year that Brian Hegland, I think, won a Razzie and an Oscar for screenwriting in the same year for The Postman and L.A. Confidential.
It's amazing how careers work, right?
Yeah. When did you first see this one?
Prince of Egypt I saw on video, and that was just, I guess, the next year after it came out in theaters. And, you know, obviously a big Val Kilmer fan. I mean, if you couldn't guess. I watch any animated film, and especially a big grand epic animated film like this would be right up my alley because I was a huge Don Bluth fan. I love, you know, all those the non-Disney animated films, or even, you know, the Bluth-esque animated films like your, you know, Treasure Island and your, those, you know, Treasure Planet, I should say, those kind of films where, it doesn't feel like Disney, but it has the quality of a Disney.
Well, and this one, certainly, I remember quite a bit about the run-up to its release, because even then I was following this stuff, you know, all the time. For example, I thought it was amusing that they originally were going to have the voice of God basically be in a combination of both genders, or without getting to that conversation, you know, gender neutral with every ethnicity they could possibly think of merged into one voice. But allegedly they just went with Kilmer instead because they were worried that certain moviegoers would be offended by the idea that God could be a woman or, God forbid, a non-white person.
Yeah, they also said that it was almost unintelligible.
And that was sort of, and again, I like this film quite a bit, but in terms of its intentions, is a weird thing of trying to be a non-denominational religious epic. And, you know, it's you know, the song, you know, When We Will, you know, We'll Believe, like, believe in what?
Yeah.
Because there was kind of sketchy on that.
Yeah.
Used the word Hebrews a few times. Do they use the word Jews? It's been a while.
A couple of times. So. Not in the song.
Okay, yeah. But, and again, you know, I'm not assigning any diabolical blame here. You know, it is what it is. It was supposed to be, you know, a globally successful animated feature. But another thing that I remember was that I went to see a film, and I honestly don't remember what it was. It was something kid-related because it was a whole bunch of animated trailers. And all of these trailers looked pedestrian at best. Mm. You know, The King and I, for example. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that one.
Non-entity. It was, yeah. And then at the end of the trailer reel, just by coincidence, you get one of the trailers of The Prince of Egypt, which just blows them out of the water in yeah. terms of scale and ambition and scope. And it's like, it really was a get off my lawn kind of thing. I always remember that just because it happened again many, many years later when I went to see, again, I don't remember the film, but it was another film in summer 2019 that had a lot of kids cartoons attached to it in terms of trailers. And you had a bunch of, you know, Secret Life of Pets 2 and Angry Birds 2 and whatever. And then at the end, that Grimdark Frozen 2 teaser pops up. It's like, one of these things is not like the other.
This is not the same neighborhood.
No. The irony, of course, is when that trailer came out, they still had no idea what the movie was about. And having seen Frozen 2, they still don't.
It's a stretch. Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned Grimm films and Grimm children's films. This film, you could argue that it's a children's film because, you know, as most Western audiences argue that any animated musical is a children's film. This is more, I think, of a family film, especially from the first opening number, Deliver Us, where this film pulls no punches because you see the slave labor being used to build Egypt. It is rough stuff compared to what you see in almost any other family film.
Yes, it was definitely a, you know, plant your flag in the sand, a statement of purpose. Mm-hmm. That this film, you know, is going to be about the story of Exodus, mm-hmm. a story that I'm sure everyone seeing the movie above a certain age would know is a very violent, tragic, and occasionally scary and very cataclysmic story. Mm-hmm. I mean, from the point of view of Egyptians, it's apocalypse.
Yeah.
It's something that I think, you know, Zack Snyder was sort of playing with in Man of Steel, which at its best you could look at as a story of Exodus, but what if Moses aligned himself with the Egyptians against his own people? Mm. But yeah, and normally I'd say that I, you know, other than the plague sequences and or the one plague sequence involving the dead kids at the end, the film never gets anywhere near as violent and dark as it does in that opening credits in the prologue.
No, that really sets a stage.
And that's what I like to call the Pan's Labyrinth principle. Guillermo del Toro mentioned in the Pan's Labyrinth commentary that the opening murder in that scene where the evil general beats a man to death with a bottle of wine and then shoots him. And while the film is violent and there's quite a bit of tragic death, there's no scene in the film that's as gory or as gruesome as that scene. And by starting here, you can play it closer to the vest in terms of the violence for the rest of the picture. Because the audience is already aware what the stakes are.
That's an interesting idea. I think that works here for sure, because you are constantly under threat in this film. You know, because right off the bat after that,
yes.
You know, you've got the scene with the slaves, and then we get the traditional tale of baby Moses being sent down the river by his mother. Except in this time, now we get a gauntlet because there's alligators and hippos and yes. fishermen and giant boats. This is not the story we've been shown of baby Moses for the most part. This is a bit more heightened than we're used to in this kind of film.
The last time I watched it, this was a few months ago, I watched it with the family just because my kids hadn't seen it. I was curious. I figured, what the heck? And they liked it. But, you know, my daughter, who's 13 and very droll and sarcastic during the opening scene, just at random during the musical number, she says, "Stop singing it. They'll hear you." Anyway, I just want to share that anecdote.
Well, the heightening continues then after, because we get a chariot race between Ramesses and his now adopted brother Moses, voiced by Ralph Fiennes, and Val Kilmer. I think Kilmer is an excellent choice for Moses. He really brings that sense of a hero, sense of self-doubt, and finds maybe even better as Ramesses, because he brings that royalty, that feeling of somebody who is born into this role and believes in himself to be the god king. What did you think of the leads?
Well, I mean, Kilmer's work almost goes without saying. He chews onto a very meaty role. And I think Kilmer is always somebody that, I don't want to say he thought he was too good for a lot of his mass market entertainments, but I do think he was somebody that thought very highly of himself. Ergo, something like this, I imagine, would be something he considered a worthy challenge. Voicing Moses in a PG-rated Exodus cartoon, definitely intended for kids, but aimed at discerning older kids and their parents. As for Fiennes, I mean, I just wish he had more scene. Because, the one brief bit he gets in the plagues, he's terrific.
Oh, it's an amazing scene.
And, obviously he was cast as after Schindler's List. Although, that was, 5 years later. And he had played a number of very wary, tragic, beaten down villains at that point. That was the weird thing about the Avengers, the other Avengers that opened, summer 98, is I used to joke it was the first time we ever saw Ralph Fiennes smile. And he's terrific. It's just the two of them. And what this film does well, and I would say better than any of the other versions, either the Ten Commandments or Exodus, it does most things better than Exodus, is that it really highlights the brotherly relationship. To where a very micro story of an impossible family conflict that takes place between two brothers who genuinely like each other and respect each other and would otherwise look out for each other amid this giant macro, literally the wrath of God epic. And so, I think that the story by, partially it's because, it's a PG-rated movie for families. So emphasizing the brotherly affection between these two is a meaty subject matter that doesn't require an R rating.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the smartest thing they did about this film, like you said, is that you have this massive story of, Moses being tasked by God to lead the Jews out of the slavery in Egypt. But at the bottom of it, in the middle is this brotherly conflict. It's a classic sibling rivalry.
Yeah.
And it's not even, like you said, it's not even something where it's two people who are really against each other. It's two people going in opposite directions. And so you have one who is going to be the next king and has all those expectations upon him, and the other one who's his kid brother, who's shielded from all of it and can do his own thing. And that creates the drama between them that, otherwise you'd have to create some sort of head-to-head clash between them, even though that eventually becomes, because of, like you said, the macro story, we get that clash. But at its core, it's a really intimate story.
Yeah, and in a skewed way, I mean, yes, Ramesses is the bad guy. He's has slaves and murders people.
Oh yeah.
But from his point of view, he's not wrong. I mean, he's doing things the way things have been done for thousands of years. All of a sudden his brother, who he hasn't seen in 10, 15 years, shows up and says, the purple spaghetti monster in the sky told me you have to release all of these people. And if he doesn't, I'm gonna set your whole town on fire. I mean,
yeah, what do you do with that?
Yeah. It's not a matter of, ooh, my brother, the pesky good guy. It's my brother, the raving lunatic.
Yeah. It's funny because you just said my pesky good guy brother. I think if Prince of Egypt came out a few decades later, you would have had Moses derided as a social justice warrior, because in this movie, he really is the guy who's looking out for the little guy at all times. And that also adds to this conflict here, because he's worried about the treatment of the Jewish slaves. He feels bad about Zipporah being enslaved for his pleasure. He defends the little kids when they're being bullied. I wonder if you brought this film out now, what would the reaction to this film? would it now be a divisive film?
Yes and no. I mean, I think outside of the social media discourse, it would not be controversial. I think a lot of what we, again, it's film Twitter is not the real world.
This is true.
Facebook discourse is not the real world. YouTube videos are not the real world. Even a lot of what I do is not the real world. I'm aware of that. I especially the fact that I'm a box office pundit and a film critic. And I know sometimes those, there are plenty of times where I have given a film a negative review for the very reasons that it would go on to be a huge hit. Force Awakens, the first It movie, Beauty and the Beast, obviously. It doesn't mean I'm wrong, and the people that enjoy the movie are wrong, but I think after 9/11, which was 3 years after this film, you know, one of the consequences of the Bush era is that we started to politicize what used to be conventional right and wrong issues. You know, torture is bad. Arresting innocent people without trial is bad. You know, destroying the environment is bad. You know, so what, you know, you talk about 10 years later, 10 years earlier. I mean, Avatar comes out in 2009. It's basically very similar in terms of politics to Aliens, because that's who James Cameron is. And now it's all political movie. It's left-wing propaganda. Like, really? It's arguing that corporations shouldn't murder people. That didn't used to be a controversial concept. And so, yeah, I do think there has been a politicization of what used to be cut and dried moral righteousness. Unfortunately, in the Trump era, what we saw is a politicization of just old school human decency. You know, just not being a dick. pardon my French. I'm not allowed to cuss on this.
You're fine.
So yeah, I think had the film come out today, there would be lots of think pieces on the left and think pieces on the right, or what Prince of Egypt gets wrong about Exodus, or you know what, you know, why Moses should have done this, or why Ramesses wasn't all that bad, or, and that stuff's fine as long as they're well written and they're written in good faith. But the general audience doesn't care. I mean, the general audience, you know, didn't read all the Green Book think pieces. They didn't read all the Bohemian Rhapsody think pieces. They didn't walk into Joker thinking he was going to start an incel riot. Now that's all in this weird bubble that I'm a member of. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Echo chamber, circular firing squad, call it what you will. I think there's a problem when people in that environment think that those conversations are the mainstream. And again, you know, not to beat a, you know, repeat something, but I think Disney fell for it. I think they saw the online boo-hoo, Rian Johnson killed Star Wars, and reacted badly.
Terribly.
Where if they had just said, okay, some people don't like this movie for objectively valid reasons, that's fine. But it got an A from CinemaScore. Most of the reviews were good. It made $620 million domestic and $1.33 billion worldwide.
What's the problem?
We're not going to panic here.
Yeah.
The same way that Marvel didn't panic after Avengers Age of Ultron got nicked by post-debut, ooh, it's so problematic. You know, the film still made $1.4 billion.
Yeah. What are you going to cry about?
Exactly. So to answer your question, I do think there'd be lots of consternation online, but I don't think it would impact the real-world reception of the film.
Well, let's talk about something that would be a little less controversial, which would be the music in the film, because this is, in the end, a musical. There are several big musical numbers. We mentioned, you know, Deliver Us, which gets things off to a rousing start. Most of the songs are very Disney Broadway style. And there's, in my opinion, nothing that really is a breakout song. Do you? Is there anything here that you think is a big enough number to be a breakout song?
The only, I mean, I like Deliver Us. I like... The two songs I really like are ones that basically tell the story throughout, you know, they aren't like stop, you know, showstoppers. You know, You're Playing with the Big Boys Now is a showstopper that everyone fast forwards when they watch the film. the Heaven's Light is a showstopper. Yeah, they kind of get married right at the end of it, but it's not, you know, it does kind of stop the story in order to have a song. The Plague Song is terrific, but it's also just sort of glorified montage. I mean, it's I don't want to say it's barely a song because that's not fair, but it's story. It's more operatic in the sense that, you know, operas where they're singing all the time.
Yes.
In terms of the big, you know, you're absolutely right. It's trying to at least somewhat approximate the stereotypical Disney song. The same thing with Anastasia the year prior from Fox and Don Bluth. Then of course the You Will Believe song right at the end, which is a perfectly fine song, but again, narratively, it's redundant.
Yeah.
You know, they've already won.
Yeah. And I can't believe that song won an Oscar because I mean,
oh, I can.
But I mean, yeah, well, it happened. I don't deny reality, but
it was genetically engineered to win an Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston. You know, it's hard to argue, especially, and then DreamWorks promotion behind it obviously is going to help. But funny to me, I like the version in the film proper more than I like the version by Houston and Carey.
I feel that way about most animated covers.
Mm.
And I wouldn't even say that's necessarily a criticism, because I mean, for to use an obvious example, I think the radio contemporary cover of Let It Go is perfectly fine, but the version in the movie is obviously better.
Mm.
I think the contemporary cover of How Far We'll Go from Moana is fine, but the one in the movie is better.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is because you have context.
Mm.
You associate with the story that's being told in that moment. I'm still pissed that we never got a contemporary cover of Hellfire from The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Hmm.
Alice Cooper would have crushed that.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
But so, no, I mean, I don't disagree with you, but I also, that was not a surprise to me. The radio cover was there to be on the radio and to drum up publicity for the film by having these mainstream musicians singing the song on talk shows, plugging the film on late night, and so forth and so forth.
I think my main problem with it is the lyrics are very awkward to the song. They are really shoved into
it. I think that goes toward the whole, this is a religious song, but we can't talk about religion.
Mm, yeah, you have to overexplain everything.
So it's this weird, it's a deeply generic boilerplate spiritual number that is not allowed to offer any specifics.
Why don't we talk about the animation? Because, I mean, obviously, this film was one of DreamWorks' earliest films. And a massive project, 4 years in the making. And it had a real good mix of 3D and 2D animation. Some of the 3D animation doesn't look so great nowadays in comparison. The Red Sea's parting is okay. It's not super great. But I mean, when this film really flexes its animation muscles, it really looks fantastic. And one thing I'm thinking about is when Moses has his flashback to his origin and they do the hieroglyphic style animation, that is really impressive and creative work right there. What did you think about that?
I think it's a wonderfully animated film. My only regret is that it wasn't shot in scope, which I found puzzling even in 1998, because I mean, A Bug's Life was in scope, for goodness sakes. So yes, most animated films were in 1.85 at that point, but for this film that was willfully, you know, very much advertising itself as a big epic animated adventure.
Yeah.
But it's not widescreen. And again, if this was, you know, 2009 and you had IMAX screens, I would understand that. But this was not, you know, that was not in play.
No.
But in terms of what we did, yes, it's a wonderfully animated picture. And to be fair, DreamWorks tried to keep 2D alive. They really did. You know, it's not like they, you know, made ants and just said, whatever. You know, nobody showed up to Sinbad. I don't blame them, but nobody showed up to Sinbad.
No.
Nobody showed up to Road to El Dorado, to be honest.
Sure.
I mean, they were, you know, Chicken Run was a big hit, but that was an acquisition. That was an acquisition. It was, you know, a deal with Hardiman.
Mm-hmm.
That was obviously stop motion animation, which is a whole different can of worms.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I mean, it's excellent 2D animation. It's vivid. It's colorful. It's detailed.
Mm-hmm.
It has a flexibility and diversity of motion. And yes, that some of the 3D effects have aged, but I mean, it doesn't bother me because the movie around it is good enough.
Mm.
It's not a film that lives or dies by its effects.
Mm. And one of the things I really like about it is it has its own unique look to it. You know, none of these characters look like much of I've seen any other film. You don't have that stock style of animation. And that, I mean, part of that is the area that we're looking at. They're trying to create some sort of, you know, authenticity to the ethnicity of the characters. And so they lent the animation style a different look that way. And I really appreciate that. And it does look a lot like El Dorado, though, in the end, because I think they kind of liked that look for this and added on to El Dorado as well, probably in development at the same time. But I do appreciate that DreamWorks didn't just go for a stock look and had their own style and design to this film. And it made a difference, too, in the end.
Yeah, I would agree. I have nothing more to add on that.
When we get to the end of this film, does it feel like, because one of the things I noticed and watching it again is that this movie, when you take the credits out, is just 90 minutes. It is a 90-minute fast film.
Yeah, it's a short picture.
And it covers a lot of ground, but it feels like it just kind of like ends. Well, like the plague is such a big part of the plague scenes are such a big part of the story, the plot. They kind of just go through those pretty quickly, except for obviously The Last Plague, where they aim for a little bit of, you know, emotion there. Obviously, they try to twist the dagger a bit with that one. But then from there on, it is almost a sprint. Did you feel like the film kind of runs through its end, especially then once we get the tablets out of nowhere?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the movie ends where, oh, he's got the Ten Commandments now, which, if you remember the story, it's not a happy ending if you remember what happens next. I was like, shouldn't all these people be like, you know, sodomizing each other or whatever? And they seem happy. I don't think he's going to break those tablets this time. But yeah, it's, I think, absent the expectation that audiences would have to see the two stone tablets at some point in this picture, The movie probably would have ended with them all walking off into the, you know, through the ocean. After, you know, when you believe would basically just fade to credits right then and there. But, you know, you can't necessarily do, you know, and 4 years later, they all, you know, they all went Event Horizon crazy. And then, you know, Moses broke the tablets and happy ending, roll credits. I think, you know, understandably, they're trying to have their cake and eat it too, in that sense, where they want to have the Ten Commandments, which is obviously one of the reasons why we even tell this story, but also have a happy ending. Mm. And if you argue that the high of Moses's quest was when they parted the Red Sea and got the hell out of Egypt, then That's where you end the story.
Yeah, leave them wanting more. Is there anything about this film that we haven't covered that you wanted to talk about?
It and Looney Tunes Back in Action contain one of the few bad Steve Martin performances.
It's funny you talk about those guys.
I think he's, you know, he's one of our finest comic actors, yada, yada, yada. He's a great dramatic actor too, yada, yada, yada. But I think sometimes when he's in all ages films, he sort of hams it up more than he should. Mm. Obviously the Pink Panthers, this likewise. I mean, I adore Looney Tunes Back in Action, but, you know, it's the one movie that makes Steve Martin look like a worse actor than Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan knew not to try to steal scenes from Daffy Duck.
Yeah, Hotep and Hoi are probably my least favorite part of this film because they feel so Disney. They feel like those comic, you know, characters they just shove in. Yeah. And the Eddie Murphy, I can't think of
Gargoyles.
The other ones. Yes, that you just shove into the film for the kids, and they're not necessary, especially in this film.
Yeah, and they are a commercial consideration.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, we're going to give you a lot of money to make this darker, grimmer, less comedic, you know, animated adventure drama, but you got to give us something here. Mm. You got to give us some goofy characters that we can have a goofy song the kids will laugh at right in the middle of the movie. Mm-hmm. You can use them in the previews to assure parents it's not all a slog. I don't like them. I don't like the song. I think they are artistically unnecessary, But commercially, I get it.
Yep.
Especially back then.
Mm. Yeah, I think it might have been a risk to make this movie without something to show in the trailer like that. Something to say, this is some laughs here.
And my favorite scene in the film, it's right between the nine plagues and the last plague, when Ramesses and Moses have a real heart-to-heart, and they almost come to peace with each other. They're This close before his son shows up and, you know, understandably gets pissed at Moses. Mm. And then, you know, Ramesses reverts, understandably, again, you know, putting aside the fact that the guy's, you know, a genocidal tyrant, in the sense, in movie world morality, you understand why he reacts the way he does.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so close, so close.
Yeah.
You almost avoided, you know, all these dead kids.
Yeah.
And everything else, all the drowned soldiers. And it's tragic.
Yeah, I can always appreciate a villain who has some logic.
Yeah.
A villain with logic is always going to make things better, and that's definitely where Ramesses is.
He doesn't have to be justified, but he has to be logical. You're right.
Yeah.
And I don't have an issue with villains with good motives. My issue is that I think 30 years of making films with sympathetic bad guys with sympathetic motives, playing to frankly very dumb moviegoers, has led to a generation that sort of associates, well, their moral makes sense, so really they're not really a bad guy.
Mm. Good point, and a sad point, to be sure. Now that we've had our say, let's hear from the man himself.
It's time for a reading from the Book of Val.
Today's reading comes from Val Kilmer's memoir, I'm Your Huckleberry. There's a very brief mention of the Prince of Egypt in a chapter otherwise devoted to Mark Twain for some reason. So oddly enough, I've played Moses three times. The first was in The Prince of Egypt, a sleeper Disney hit with a massive all-star cast that includes Michelle Pfeiffer and Ralph Fiennes, with music by Hans Zimmer and Stephen Schwartz, sung by Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey. Though making the movie was a solitary experience, me alone in a sound booth, the final product was charming and beloved family fare. Thanks be to Val. I find it amusing that Kilmer doesn't even separate DreamWorks from Disney. And I wonder how many filmgoers actually recognize the difference between the two.
Less than you'd think. Or they think everything's Disney.
Yeah, right?
And I think that's part of Disney's scheme. It's one reason why they, you know, Bob Iger wanted to accumulate more stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they buy Fox, and then predominantly Fox properties like Night at the Museum or Home Alone or Greatest Showman become associated with Disney for the next generation. Mm-hmm. Or Willow, you know, a flop or disappointment mm-hmm. from 35 years ago from MGM. They get a new Willow TV series sequel, then that entire franchise becomes part of the Disney umbrella. Mm. It's insidious, and I don't even say that in a moral sense, but it's. I think they're banking on the general ignorance of most people. Which, very to be true. Fair, I mean, if you're a regular person, you don't care any more than I know who won the last Super Bowl.
Now that we have had our say and Val Kilmer has had his say, why don't we hear from some other people?
Come, children, let's explore the Kills and Valleys.
Kills and Valleys, the best and worst reviews of this film. On Rotten Tomatoes, The Prince of Egypt sports an 80% fresh rating, which is, you know, acceptable, I think, in my opinion, since Rotten Tomatoes can be so weirdly flexible as far as what it reviews films as. We'll take a look at Roger Ebert from the Chicago Sun-Times, who said, The Prince of Egypt is one of the best-looking animated films ever made. The movie is not shy about being entertaining, but it maintains a certain seriousness. It addresses a different place in the moviegoer's mind, one where vision, imagination, and dream are just barely held in by the story. I mean, that pretty much covers it, I think. And obviously, I'm not going to argue with Roger Ebert. He can say whatever he wanted to. And I would probably agree, or at least enjoy what he wrote.
I mean, it got generally positive reviews when it came out.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, Manola Dargis of LA Weekly was not as impressed. She said, thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbor's. Maybe DreamWorks should stop trying to be Disney.
Conventional wisdom is hard to bust.
Yeah, I mean, yes, they should try not to be Disney by doing those two characters, the comedic characters, Hotep and Hui, but otherwise, you know, if you're going to go for the best, you might as well, you know, go for Disney when it comes to animated films and try to top them.
Well, and, you know, you have to remember this was 1998 where there was Disney and then there was basically nothing else.
This is
true. Except for the periodic, you know, Don Bluth picture.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, again, a year before, Anastasia was considered this huge deal because it was a rival studio taking a crack at the Disney empire. Mm. And now Anastasia is available to watch on Disney Plus.
Oh, how things change. The Village Voice's Jay Hoberman was also a blasphemer. This homage to The Lion King, notwithstanding, Prince of Egypt's weakest aspect is Stephen Schwartz's stale, sub-Godspell score, filled with simpering ballads and tremulous inspirationals. Now there, I can't really argue. The music does not really jump out to me as being very interesting in this film.
No, it's a serviceable score.
Yeah.
It's not a memorable one. And it doesn't always have to be. I mean, not every score is made to be listened to on a CD in the car.
This is true, but when you have a biblical epic like this, you really want to feel it. And I don't think this music makes you feel it in the way that, you know, you really think you should.
Especially when, you know, frankly, the scores for the Disney films of that era, Lion King, Hunchback of Notre Dame, even Tarzan to a certain extent, were just frankly knocking it out of the park.
Yeah. Over on Amazon, as of last check, the Unwashed Masses have left us 10,554 ratings, of which a remarkable 91% are 5-star. People really love this film on Amazon. The funny thing is that they've broken into basically two chapters. So let's see if you can recognize why they like this film. Say what you will about God, but this movie is absolutely outstanding. That's a weird thing to say about a movie.
Boy.
I love this movie growing up. It's not accurate to the Bible, but it's fun for kids and has a lot of great music to sing along to. Basically, everything fell into either they love movies about God,
born despite of.
Yeah, or they watch the movie growing up. Then there's these people. Now, most people who know me know I don't always enjoy animated films. You know, this guy's very well known, obviously. In fact, it's so rare that this was the first animated film I actually purchased. And boy, could I have ever cried that I did not see this film in theaters. It is simply beautiful. I think it is eye and ear candy, but that sounds a little like putting it down. This film is just great. Now, it ain't better than the Ten Commandments, but it does a decent job and should not be compared to the Ten Commandments.
It's funny he says that, because that reminds me of something that crossed my mind earlier that I completely forgot about, which is that, you know, the film opens with a chariot race, which is iconography entirely associated with the other giant biblical epic of that era.
Yep.
They really are trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Certainly. You know, you gotta, I guess there's just not enough action in the Ten Commandments for the filmmakers. You gotta throw a little bit from some other areas. Though a lot of people do like this film, 1% of Amazon reviews were one star. Actually, the majority of the negative reviews focused on the quality of the version they received. That, I guess there was a Blu-ray version that had pretty bad visual quality, but there were some other problems. I don't know what Bible they got this story from, but it's all wrong. If you in the truth, don't watch unless you're going to use it for a lesson on how Hollywood will rewrite the Bible for their own use.
You're not wrong.
Entertaining, but so far from the text of the Bible, it is apostate. God gets no glory in this movie. I would not recommend it to anyone. Then there's some other people who have a different problem with the film. This film is not good for kids. Very inappropriate for kids. My husband and I found it interesting enough. We're huge fans of DreamWorks, but our boys refused to even finish the movie. Our oldest son even ran to his room sobbing, "This movie is mean and horrible. I guess we will not be watching this one again."
How old are these children?
That's a good question. This movie is mean and horrible. I mean,
last I checked, kids like seeing stuff that's inappropriate for them.
Usually, right? I'm going to guess those are Ned Flanders kids. Well, we have a decision to make about this film.
With or without Val.
Do you think Val Kilmer makes or breaks this film?
Oh, that's a more complicated question than I thought. On one hand, I'm inclined, like, of course not. It's the animation and the scale and the whatever. But if we're being honest, you know, the movie doesn't work if Moses doesn't work. Mm. It's a Moses movie.
Yeah.
Everything else aside. So with the caveat that I did not, I expected him to be good, and he was good. Shocker. Person good at acting acts good in a movie. But, okay, fine. Yeah, he makes the movie, yes. Because the movie, it's a singular character feature, and it's a Moses movie that can't work if we don't buy Moses.
And plus, he plays God.
And he plays God, yeah. And we got paid twice. And I think the SAG can do three characters, though, so I don't know if that works.
Yeah, I don't know. He didn't play anybody else, no. So they didn't get their money's worth out of Val. Well, now we are going to play a game, and it's called Disney or Dad. Now, obviously, as you mentioned before, DreamWorks and Disney, they have a long rivalry, particularly in the animated space, which makes a lot of sense. Like you said, Jeffrey Katzenberg tried to take down Disney after being forced out by forming DreamWorks. But these two studios are way more similar than they are different. And so for this game, I'm going to give you a film title, and you'll try to tell me if it's a Disney production or a DreamWorks production. This might be trickier than you think, but you also might just go 10 for 10 because, you know, you're the movie guy. So let's see what happens. So number one, Surviving Christmas.
Oh, crap. These are live action. I'm pretty sure that's Disney, Buena Vista.
Surviving Christmas is DreamWorks.
Yeah.
So 0-1. Number two, the Jackie Chan film, The Tuxedo.
That's DreamWorks.
You are correct. That is a DreamWorks film.
That film is not good, but I enjoyed it anyway.
Yeah, you know, that's Jennifer Love Hewitt in there too, right?
Yes.
Yep, solid film. Around the World in 80 Days.
I think that's DreamWorks as well.
You would be Incorrect. That is a Disney film. See, it is harder than I thought. Oh, yay.
It is. Number four. Like, you know which, we know which movies are DreamWorks tunes and Disney tunes. What's going on here?
Couldn't make it that easy. Next one is Hotel for Dogs.
I think that's Disney. I think that was like Buena Vista or whatever, Hollywood Pictures or whatever the hell. It's, yeah. I'm going with Disney.
The only thing I remember about it is the tennis ball in the logo, and that tennis ball was brought to us by DreamWorks.
Oh. Where's DreamWorks? Make Schindler's List for kids.
The Wild.
Oh, that's Disney.
You are correct. That is Disney. To me, it feels like a knockoff. It feels like it would have been the DreamWorks version. Kind
of knockoff the DreamWorks Madagascar.
Exactly. It's backwards. The next one, the BFG.
That's Disney.
This is a trick question. It was both a Disney, and a DreamWorks production. Trick question.
DreamWorks when they were owned by Disney. Not owned, but they,
For only time they collaborate, I believe.
Yes, for that kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, for Spielberg. Next one, The Soloist.
I think that's DreamWorks.
The Soloist, starring Robert Downey Jr., is from DreamWorks.
God, I'm terrible at this game.
You said DreamWorks. You got it right. You got it right.
Oh, I did? I don't even know what I said.
You said DreamWorks.
Oh, it's been a
day. How about the horse film Dreamer?
I got to go with DreamWorks because I honestly don't. Yeah, I'm going to go with DreamWorks.
See, originally I thought it was Spirit, which is a DreamWorks animated film, but it also is DreamWorks because apparently DreamWorks really likes horses.
Yes.
How about Mars Needs Moms?
Oh, Disney would like me to tell you it's DreamWorks, but it's not.
It is Disney. You are correct. a big failure on their part. And then the last one, Casey Affleck and Chris Pine in The Finest Hours.
That is Disney, early 2016.
And you are correct. Great job. You nailed a lot more than you thought at first.
I was worried at first.
I'm glad it was a little trickier than I thought it was going to be.
The kind of movies they don't make anymore, because that's what a lot of those are.
Exactly. Well, that's all for this episode of KilmerCast. I'd love to thank you, Scott, for joining me to chat about this visual feast and this epic film.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
I write for Forbes. I've got a Twitter feed at Scott Mendelson. Other than that, yeah.
So check him out on Twitter. See what's happening with all the, and try to figure out what the multiplier is, because I have read Scott forever now, and I still have trouble figuring it all out. It's a science that he is the master of.
I appreciate that.
In our next episode, we'll be heading to 2008 and Behind Bars for the prison film Felon. In the meanwhile, please email any thoughts, questions, or comments to kilmercast@gmail.com and follow the show on Twitter at kilmercast. For myself and my guest, Scott Mendelson, thank you for listening, and remember to keep it Kilmer.